From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, some creatures great and small, documentary filmmakers Beverly and Derek Joubert tell us about being charged by an elephant. They've devoted their lives to filming Africa's disappearing wildlife. Their film Reflections on Elephants just won a Peabody Award. Biologist E.O. Wilson has found his inspiration not in the wilds of Africa, but in his own backyard. He'll tell us about studying the industrious ant. Wilson is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Ants. And a new CD reissue, Charlie Parker with Strings, inspires some reflections from commentator Gerald Early. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A federal judge has granted an injunction that would restore Major League Baseball's salary arbitration and free agent bidding rules. Team owners had changed those terms of the players' contract unilaterally several months after the players went on strike. The National Labor Relations Board had asked for the injunction after ruling the changes unfair labor practices. The players' union had said it would end the strike if the injunction were granted. The owners have not made it clear whether they would accept the players back or lock them out and try to open the season on Sunday with replacement players. The U.S. handed over the peacekeeping mission in Haiti to the United Nations today. The U.S. had led that effort since the fall, when U.S. troops cleared the way for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to return to power. In Port-au-Prince today, President Clinton praised American soldiers for their work.
You have defended democracy and made it stronger here. You have shown the Haitians what it means to be a soldier in a free society, working for the people, not against them. And when you go home, you must know that you have inspired a new generation of Haitians, supported by the United Nations mission, to carry on the never-ending struggle for freedom.
While Mr. Clinton said there is a long road ahead for Haiti's democracy, he did not directly mention this week's assassination of a right-wing opposition leader. Diplomats in Haiti are implicating President Aristide's interior minister, who they say hired the gunman. Defense Secretary William Perry has arrived in Ukraine to begin a four-nation tour that will also take him to Russia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Defense Secretary Perry told reporters Ukraine has removed the nuclear warheads from its SS-24 long-range missiles and half its SS-19s. More than half of these warheads, most once aimed at the United States, have been shipped to Russia for destruction. Calling this a remarkable development, Perry said Ukraine will be rid of all nuclear arms by the end of next year. Ukraine's parliament had balked at giving up all its nuclear weapons, but Washington threatened and coaxed Kiev with promises of financial help. Perry's trip is designed to intensify military contacts with the former Soviet republics, and by highlighting the benefits of U.S. involvement, he hopes to persuade a skeptical Congress funds for disarmament are an investment in peace. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The government says orders to American factories were down 0.2 of a point in February. It was the first decline in 4 months, but it had been expected by analysts. The Commerce Department says the biggest drops were in electronic and communications equipment. New orders are an important measure of U.S. manufacturing activity. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 15.5 points at 41.57 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Grammy Award-winning singer Selena has died of a gunshot wound in Corpus Christi, Texas. Police say the shooting occurred at a Days Inn motel and that a suspect kept police at bay in a parking lot, sitting in a pickup truck and holding a gun to the singer's head. The 23-year-old Selena was an idol of Mexican-American teenagers and sang a style of music called Tejano. A neighbor of O.J. Simpson testified today that he did not see a white Bronco parked outside Simpson's house the night of the murders. The absence of the Bronco is critical to the state's case because prosecutors say Simpson drove the Bronco to Nicole Simpson's condo and there murdered his ex-wife and Ronald Goldman. NPR's Renee Montaigne has this report.
The neighbor, a well-off investor named Charles Kale, was doing what everyone on the West Side seemed to be doing that night, walking his dog. Kale says he was out with the dog between 9:30 and 9:45 p.m. and is quite sure he didn't see the Bronco. Kale testified that when he passed by again early the next morning, he did see the Bronco as well as a police car, and he testified, remarked on how odd it was to see the Bronco there since he hadn't seen it before. Kale also noticed that the Bronco was parked at, quote, a strange angle. During cross-examination, the defense's Robert Shapiro questioned Kale's perceptions and memory, at one point bringing out that Kale hadn't seen Simpson's Bentley pull in, though house guest Cato Kalin has testified that Simpson and he returned in the Bentley from McDonald's around 9:35. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
Japanese police have stepped up their moves against a religious sect suspected in the nerve gas attack on the Tokyo subway. Police arrested two sect members today for illegal possession of sodium, which can be explosive when it touches water. After treating the group carefully for more than a week, police have been arresting members of the sect whenever possible, including two who were detained for driving a car with an out-of-state, or rather out-of-date, inspection. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Filmmakers Derek and Beverly Joubert shoot scenes most of us will never get to see firsthand, like hyenas feasting on a zebra and elephants mating. This week, the Jouberts won a Peabody Award for Best Documentary for their National Geographic special, Reflections on Elephants. It followed some of the last free-roaming African elephants in northern Botswana. Reflections on Elephants was the Jouberts' sixth National Geographic special. The Jouberts rarely see other people. They live in the bush most of the year, tracking animals in their customized jeep. They usually emerge from their camp only to edit their films. Actually, they're currently in the States doing some production work on their latest film. The Jouberts, who are married, grew up in South Africa and met in high school. I spoke with them last February, just before the broadcast of Reflections on Elephants. Their film has a rare scene of an elephant dying. This was an old elephant the Jouberts had been tracking for several months. They'd first seen this elephant in 1981. I asked them to describe the death.
First of all, it was an intensely dry time, so he was desperate for water. There wasn't a lot of grazing around as well, so what they had to do, all the bulls, is leave the area and go and graze and then walk at least 2 to 3 kilometers or more back to the water. And there's very little water around, so most of the healthy bulls had really dominated the water area and he couldn't get to it. And he stood around through the heat of the day and into the night for hours waiting to get to water, and eventually he braved it and he went in. And once he started to drink, one of the more dominant bulls actually jostled with him and moved him off, and he still didn't move. And of course, he eventually got a tusk right into the side of his neck, and he dropped down and bled to death. He was just so weak that he just couldn't get up, and he died there.
Why would an elephant gore a member of its own herd?
Well, I don't think he intentionally meant to gore him, obviously not even knowing the weakness that that bull was in. But that is the way that they perform around water that is so little at the time. And the more dominant bull would drink first and then move off, and then the second one in charge would drink, and that's the way it would go. And if somebody steps out of line, the bull that would be drinking that is in charge will definitely just try and put that one bull back into line. And that's what happened. I think it was more an accidental death.
How did the elephants respond when this one elephant was dying?
It was stunning, actually. We didn't even realize what we were going to witness, but we moved in there for about 8 days and eight nights to follow the complete cycle of this death and the carcass. The other bulls spent a lot of time around that carcass. They would go up to it and they'd smell it and they would investigate the carcass all the time, paying particular attention to the ivory, I might add. But there were some really eerie moments where, in particularly in the early afternoon, about 4 in the afternoon, the bulls would all gather around this carcass and simply stand there for 15 or 20 minutes, not doing anything, not even smelling it. And then they'd all disperse again. So it was a very moving and touching time, I think.
How long did it take after the elephant died for the hyenas to come and start feeding on the corpse?
It was actually very quick, because they actually heard the death screams of this elephant. And they were also in the vicinity at the time because obviously they wanted water as well. So I would say it was almost 20 minutes at the most and they were there. They didn't start feeding straight away because the bulls wouldn't allow them to feed. First of all the other elephants came in and they started, first of all, trying to pick the carcass up. And some of the bulls, that the younger bulls, all of a sudden started doing a mock mating display on the bull that had died on the carcass. And shortly after, once the bulls had left the carcass, did the hyenas come in. But then the bulls constantly would come in and chase the hyenas periodically through the night.
How many days does it take for the elephant corpse to be consumed?
This one was remarkably quick. It was 8 days and 8 nights.
Are there any leftover parts? What happens to the ivory?
Mm-hmm. Well, the bones get scattered for a start. Hyenas, you know, run off with bits and pieces of bones. And what happened in this particular case is that the ivory was pulled on the day by an elephant and then dropped in the mud and then stood on by other elephants and then disappeared. And then some months later, an elephant worked away at a piece of ivory with his trunk and then extracted this whole tusk, walked around with it, and that's a really haunting and eerie moment.
It extracted the tusk from?
From the mud.
Oh, it had buried it?
Yeah, where it had landed, I think, accidentally. It wasn't a conscious burying of this thing, but it landed there and the mud hole dried up. But one bull eventually extracted it and then walked around with it, displayed it, and stood on it, tried to break it. We've seen this quite a lot. We've often seen elephants wander off with tusks and smash them against trees and break them against rocks and things like that.
What for?
Who knows? It's really a difficult thing to try and interpret without being too anthropomorphic. But so much of elephant behavior is focused around the mouth. So when they greet, they put a trunk into the other one's mouth, and that's the way they smell who the other one is and where they've been, what feeding's out there. And so there's so much attention paid to the mouth and the tusk area. This may be an extension of that.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert, and they make films about animals in the south of Africa. They have a National Geographic special filmed in Botswana called Reflections on Elephants. An earlier film that you made was about lions and hyenas. It was called Eternal Enemies. And you filmed them at night. I wonder if you ever felt that you were in danger watching animals fight with each other and eat each other.
No, never ever. We're very, very comfortable, in particular at night, because we've just spent so much time out there with lions and hyenas and elephants at night. I think that in particular when animals are busy killing each other or fighting or whatever they're doing, when they're active, they're so involved in their own lives that they totally ignore us. And the way that we've developed our relationship with them is to be totally inobtrusive. So we've really worked on trying to not influence us and try to just be invisible as much as possible.
Do you try to slowly condition the animals to your presence?
Yes, we do. When we're working with elephants, it's a slow approach that you have to do, usually from slightly behind so that they don't feel threatened. And the minute you see a reaction, then you start backing off or you head the other way or maybe just freeze. With animals at night, it's much more complex. We've worked sometimes with lions and hyenas for 6 weeks before we've been able to use our filming lights on them and film effectively.
Because they are more annoyed by the lights than by your presence?
Well, lights are a new thing to them. And so what we try to do is make sure that they thought of it as just something that was there, like another moon possibly. And the same thing with elephants. When we've got some night scenes in this new film of elephants, but they're mainly around waterholes, and the way that we did that is we would set up lights at the waterholes and just leave them there, go away for a couple of days at a time and allow the animals to approach the lighted area and go into it and feel comfortable there.
Has your reaction changed over the years to watching animals feeding on each other and attacking each other? Were you disturbed by it initially and then got used to it? Or, you know, was there any kind of emotional difference to your response?
Definitely disturbed in the beginning. I remember the first kill that I watched. It was a desperately sad one because it was so gruesome. And it was between, first of all, they're trying to bring down a baby zebra, and then the lions lost it to hyenas, and this baby zebra stood up again, and it was all mauled. And then, of course, they had another fight, and the lions took it over, and that's the way it carried on. And for at least a half an hour, this baby zebra hadn't been killed yet. It was still living, but yet very badly mauled. And that was desperately disturbing. And from then on, I think all the other kills were a lot easier to watch. There are times, though, when you... I think the time that I really get emotionally involved is when we get to know an animal before something terrible happens to it, and that is the worst.
But you wouldn't dream of intervening?
No, we do have a policy that we're out there to document, and if man is not interfering in any way, we're not going to interfere at all. If, for example, we came across an animal that had been badly snared, we would try and intervene, but we would never intervene in nature.
You know, I think there's two instincts that that your average person would have if they saw an animal killing another animal. One is fear that when this animal's done killing the other animal, the animal's going to turn and kill you. And the other is, you know, oh, I must stop this. You know, this is something gruesome and violent and destructive that's happening. But you're able to not act on those instincts, or maybe they don't. Maybe they're not even instincts for you anymore.
No, they're not, and you have to be logical about it. And first of all, this behavior has been going on for millions, tens of millions of years. So the one little impala that you're going to save is going to make no difference at all. And it seems futile to do that. The other thing is that while you're saving that one, in the darkness, about a half a kilometer away, it's happening again. So, you know, it's just so futile and it doesn't make any sense at all. The other thing, of course, is that while on the face of things, it may look like you've been kind to save a young zebra from being eaten by a pride of lions, those lions have cubs somewhere that need to be fed as well. And so the minute you start intervening, you start unraveling this whole tapestry, and it all falls apart in your hands.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, you know, we're out there without any firearms, without any protection at all. And when hyenas or lions have already decided that they are going to try and kill whatever it is, the blood is up. For Derek and I to jump out and to try and protect whatever it is would be futile, and we would probably get a little hurt ourselves, or we could be the next prey.
My guests are wildlife filmmakers Derek and Beverly Joubert. Their National Geographic special, Reflections on Elephants, won a Peabody Award this week for Best Documentary. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with wildlife filmmakers Beverly and Derek Joubert. They just won a Peabody for their documentary on elephants. Have you ever been attacked by an animal?
We have been attacked by an elephant cow. She was protecting her young. It was unknown to us that she or the little calf was even in the area, and she came out of the bushes charging and hit us. And she picked us up, and she rocked the vehicle a lot, and while she was hitting us, chips of her ivory were flying into the vehicle. We eventually managed to get her to leave us. It was at nighttime, and Derek shone the lights in her eyes, and she eventually left us. We were unharmed, and so was she, and luckily the calf was unharmed totally as well, and the two of them went off together.
Were you afraid?
At the time, I know, I was shaking like a leaf, and obviously the adrenaline was flowing. So I guess I was definitely afraid. But we have been hit by an elephant since then. And I think living through that experience has helped me realize that if you know your subject, you definitely can get out of a situation.
Well, but how exactly did you get out of it? How did you use your knowledge to protect yourself?
Oh, well, the first thing, of course, is we knew that a strange elephant from nowhere wouldn't like to have a strong spotlight shone in her eyes. And so while she was busy bashing this out of the vehicle, instead of jumping forward and trying to hit her with something, which would have been a bit crazy anyway, because the biggest thing that we have is a big screwdriver, I managed to find the spotlight and shone that directly in her eyes. And so she turned away and covered her eyes with her ears and moved away from the vehicle. And then immediately, strangely, I felt as though I didn't want to disturb her too much. So I switched the light off, and of course she turned and ran back and bashed us around a bit more. But then when the light went on the second time, she moved off, and I kept it on for a while.
And did you try the same thing the second time you were attacked?
No, the second time around it was during the day, and so we couldn't use that weapon of light. The second time around it was an elephant that we think had been shot by a poacher, because she had a wound that we found afterwards. But she just came out of the water and gave us almost no warning at all and just ran straight for us and smashed into the front of the vehicle. There was nothing we could do then except, actually what I did do then was, as she was about to hit, I took the vehicle out of gear so that there wouldn't be a huge amount of resistance. And she hit and she pushed us down this little track that we were on for about 100 yards or so. And then I put the brakes on, and then she felt the resistance, and that was enough for her to feel uncomfortable, and she moved off.
Do you ever run into situations where there's a competing filmmaker trying to study the same herd that you are?
We hope not. It has happened, and it's a very uncomfortable thing. We've kind of selected areas that are just so mean and miserable and tsetse fly-ridden that nobody else wants to work there.
Well, how do you deal with the misery of the of the area you're surrounded yourself with, like the insects? Which, by the way, can cause terrible illness.
Yes, they can. Well, there's normally a precaution. I mean, for mosquitoes, there's a precaution, and you can sleep on a mosquito net, and, you know, that can help. When we're working at nighttime with the lights, actually, that is the worst, because that attracts every single insect that is around. And they're insects that actually give out formaldehyde. They're called blister beetles. And what happens there is they put a formaldehyde onto your body, and huge blisters form on your body. And then, of course, the tsetse flies got a nasty burn. And luckily, because we're not in areas where we're close to villages, the tsetse flies do not carry sleeping sickness. So we're fortunate in that way, that if you stay away from other communities, you normally will be safe, that you're not going to get the illness.
Boy, you know, I'm just thinking about what it's like when you have a porch light shining in the summer in the United States, and the insects from all the neighborhoods come to your porch light and just swarm around. It must be incredible in Africa when you're working at night with the lights.
It is, especially when I'm holding the lights. I mean, my whole body is just covered. It's like my body's black with insects. But I can't move because Derek is filming, and we can't move the vehicle because, you know, that's almost his tripod.
So what kind of protective clothing are you wearing?
No protective clothing at all. But I'm not wriggling around or squashing them or anything like that, so normally I'm fine.
One of the problems is that even though it's nighttime out there in the insect season, it's very, very hot. And so we're using just the barest minimum of clothing, so we don't have a lot of protection from these bugs.
Now, Beverly, these films are really worth it to you to subject yourself to being covered from head to foot with insects while you film.
These films are our babies, so we'll go through everything.
Apparently you will go through everything. Do you think that you've been changed by living around animals and away from people?
I know I have. I think that every time we come into town, it takes us quite a lot of time to readjust when we go back. Find that we become much more intense. We become faster. We're not as thoughtful as we are when we're out in the bush. I think being around animals gives you a far better grasp on life and on death, and makes you a calmer, more peaceful person.
Beverly, what would you say?
I agree with all of that. There are times that when we first arrive in the cities that I'm very uncomfortable around people, because obviously I'm not used to all the social activities, and there are times that I might be too abrupt, because I believe that honesty is the best policy, and often you really have to be a lot more subtle. But that is what happens when you're out in the bush. You actually do feel that it's pointless playing social games. You know, you're out there, and it's really a matter of survival often. And you respect people, I think, a lot more when you're living out in the bush.
You know, I'm thinking that what one does to protect oneself is really different, say, in the city than it is in the wild. In the wild, I imagine you try to be inobtrusive, to move very slowly so as to not startle an animal, to be as unthreatening as possible. Whereas in the city, sometimes you really want to look threatening so that people don't bother you, you know, so that you look very kind of tough and sure of yourself. And, you know, you should have a kind of jaunty, assertive step when you walk through the street. It's in a way exactly the opposite of what you need to do in the wild.
That's right. In fact, you guys need guns here. We don't need guns at all. You're right. Walking in the bush, you need to be really quiet and walk slowly. And it's quite funny when people come out to us, we go out for a walk and they start striding out there, really covering distance, moving fast and swinging their arms and that sort of thing. And you don't want to do that. You know, you walk very, very slowly. I find that people in New York, for instance, walk at twice the pace that I do. And you tend to melt in a little easier. For instance, if a lion charges, what you do is you don't jump up and down and assert yourself. You stand your ground and you're quiet, but confident. And if you did, and if you started running around and waving your arms, then the lion would jump on you.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun.
Derek and Beverly Joubert won a Peabody this week for their National Geographic special, Reflections on Elephants. I spoke with them in February of 1994 when their film was first broadcast. Walt Disney's idea of elephants was slightly different from the Joubert's. From the movie Dumbo, here's the song Pink Elephants on Parade. A few years ago, on a Disney tribute record, it was performed with great affection by the avant-garde jazz group Sun Ra and his orchestra. Sun Ra and his orchestra recorded in 1988 for the Disney tribute record Stay Awake. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Charlie Parker with Strings has just been reissued. Commentator Gerald Early has been listening, and he has some reflections on the life and music of Charlie Parker. Also coming up on this archive edition, Planet of the Ants. We talk with E.O. Wilson, one of the world's foremost ant experts. He says studying them is like studying creatures from another planet. Wilson's latest book, Journey to the Ants, is a follow-up to his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Ants. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Striking Major League Baseball players say they are ready to take the field now that a federal judge has issued a preliminary injunction against team owners. The judge has ordered the teams to reinstate the players' salary arbitration and free agent bidding rules. The National Labor Relations Board had ruled the owners engaged in unfair labor practices when they unilaterally changed those terms of the players' contract. The owners have not made it clear whether they will accept the players back or lock them out until a contract settlement is reached. They have appealed today's ruling. A House panel has been hearing testimony on a bill that would repeal a ban on 19 semi-automatic assault-type weapons. President Clinton has pledged to veto the measure if Congress passes it. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
The subcommittee heard from three different panels, the first two made up of citizens who have used guns for self-defense and two criminal defense experts, all giving reasons why they oppose the assault weapons ban. Ranking Committee Democrat Charles Schumer of New York, a leading gun control advocate, asked the panelists to stop and consider for a moment the plight of New York City residents.
Who every night are terrorized by people with those guns that were bought in states with no laws at all. No restrictive laws at all, and then they get into the wrong hands.
Opponents of the assault weapons ban say it tramples Americans' constitutional right to protect themselves. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Surgeons in Boston have performed the first American operation to repair knee damage using cartilage cells grown in the laboratory. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
The new surgical technique, pioneered in Sweden, attracted international attention last fall when doctors there reported promising results. Cartilage, once damaged, doesn't naturally regrow, but the Swedish surgeons found they could harvest a patient's cartilage cells, grow them in the laboratory, and inject those cells at the site of injury, repairing the damage. Doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital have now used the technique on a 28-year-old man who injured his right knee playing softball. It'll take several months before doctors know if the surgery was a success. A Boston-area biotechnology company, which charges $10,000 per patient to grow the cartilage cells in its laboratory, expects more than 50 American surgeons to be performing the operation by the end of the year. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
The Commerce Department reports that the U.S. economy grew at an even stronger rate in the final quarter of last year than had been thought. The department says its final revised estimate of the gross domestic product for the fourth quarter shows a growth rate of 5.1%. Economists had been expecting a report of 4.6%. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 15 points to close at 4157.69. This is NPR. Police say popular Mexican-American singer Selena has died after being shot at a Corpus Christi, Texas motel. Selena was 23 years old. Her live album won the 1993 Grammy Award for Best Mexican-American Album. Her last album went quadruple platinum. She was an idol of Mexican-American teenagers. Israeli artillery bombarded at least 15 Lebanese villages facing the occupied border strip in southern Lebanon today. Reports say at least half a dozen people have been wounded. Edward Uranian reports from Beirut.
5 shells a minute rained down on villages in southern Lebanon late Friday as people sought cover where they could find it. Lebanese police reports said a number of civilians were wounded in a region which has few bomb shelters. In Beirut, pro-Iranian Hezbollah guerrillas also claimed responsibility for firing 30 Katyusha rockets into northern Israel. Hezbollah's leader, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, said the rockets were in response to an Israeli helicopter attack Friday morning, which killed one of the group's top military commanders. The people of northern Israel will know no peace, the sheikh added, so long as their counterparts in southern Lebanon are tormented. Hezbollah recently stepped up its attacks against Israeli forces, vowing to drive them out of southern Lebanon. For National Public Radio, I'm Edward Uranian in Beirut.
All 59 people aboard were killed today when a plane owned by Romania's Tarom Airlines crashed after takeoff from Bucharest and heading toward Brussels. Tarom says three Americans were among those on board. Two are identified as Norman and Virginia Hoyt, who were returning from missionary work. The airline says the plane went down in driving snow and rain just north of Bucharest. The airline has offered no idea of what caused the crash. A man who says he witnessed it reports an explosion before the plane crashed. The plane was made by Airbus. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When ants are marching across your kitchen or taking over your picnic lunch, it's unlikely that you'll pause to reflect on what fascinating creatures they are. Maybe this is a better time. My guest is one of the world's foremost ant experts, Edward O. Wilson. His 1990 book, The Ants, won him his second Pulitzer Prize. He and his co-author recently wrote a follow-up called Journey to the Ants. Wilson, who is a champion of biodiversity, also has a recent memoir called Naturalist. Wilson is a professor at Harvard and curator in entomology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. I spoke with him last fall after the publication of Journey to the Ants. In your new book, Journey to the Ants, you have these fantastic blown-up photographs of ants. This is how ants look, I guess, under a microscope, you know, if you enlarge them thousands of times. And in these enlarged photographs, the ants look a lot, to me anyways, like dinosaurs. They have dinosaur-type faces, and their little antennae look like horns coming out of the head. They look quite prehistoric to me. And in fact, the ants date back to the dinosaur era. So is that why they look the way they do?
Well, not just, it's not their great age. I think it's the fact that they have external skeletons. We are typical mammals in that we have an internal skeleton, and our tissues right out to our thin, soft skin are added like padding onto that internal skeletal structure. But insects, including ants, have it the other way around. They have their skeleton on the outside, and they have all that soft tissue on the inside. And having the hard body parts on the outside means that they build spines and plates and horns and medieval armor-like joints all over the body that does give them that dinosaur look. In fact, they're much more extreme in that regard than our dinosaurs.
I want to see ants a little more through your eyes. A lot of people see ants as just, you know, pests that attack your food when you're on a picnic or that infest your house, much to your dismay. What do the ants do that are wonderful within the larger ecosystem?
Let me introduce that by telling you the answer to the question that I most often ask about ants, and that is, what do I do about the ones in my kitchen? And my answer is always the same. Watch where you step. Be careful of little lives. Put down a little bit of cookie crumbs for them, maybe a touch of whipped cream. They like that too. And watch them for a while, and you will see a world that is as different from our own as can be imagined. It is a world of the kind that one might expect if life had been found on Mars, or as we may indeed find it on some other planet. Ants belong to an evolutionary line that diverged from our own half a billion years ago, and they achieved the numerous adaptations to the world, including their social organization in a way that's radically different from our own. So look at them as inhabitants, if you will, as another planet. And This difference includes, to come quickly to the point of what I see in them as a scientist who works on them, includes their near total reliance on chemical communication. And here they are really radically different from us. We are audio-visual creatures. We should realize that our dependence on sound and sight to get through the world and to communicate with one another is really rather exceptional in the animal world, and the ants are much more typical in being chemical. That is to say, they release substances, chemicals, secretions from all over their bodies. They have special glands for this purpose that then they pass back and forth. They taste, they smell, and it is with different chemicals that they actually are able to communicate with one another rapidly and in a sophisticated manner. For example, there are chemicals they release to alarm one another, saying, there is an enemy near.
My guest is Edward O. Wilson. He's a world-renowned naturalist and ant expert. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Edward O. Wilson. He has two new books, Journey to the Ants, and a memoir called Naturalist. You did an experiment on the chemical an ant gives off when the ant has died that communicates to the other ants that the ant is dead and needs to be carried out of the ant nest. Tell us about the experiment.
When an ant dies, just like any other dead thing, it crumples up. It may be lying on its back, but it's not noticed by the other ants rushing by it inside the nest as we would notice it, because we're visual. And the ants in the nest wait until the corpse begins to decay. And after 2 or 3 days, it's full of substances that you find in a corpse. All of these unpleasant things like trimethylamine and skatol and fatty acids and so on. And it occurred to me, we're talking back in the 50s during the early days of working out the chemical language of ants, it occurred to me that ants, probably having small brains, not being able to process very much information, depended not on all that array of charnel house smells, but probably zeroed in on a distinctive smell, and so it proved. I got this in synthetic form, many of the chemicals that are found in corpses. My laboratory was unbearable to visitors for weeks during those experiments, and I tried them one out after the other on ants that I had in the laboratory, and finally hit upon the astonishing discovery that indeed ants identify a corpse with oleic acid. When you daub oleic acid, pure oleic acid, on a piece of paper or a live ant from that nest, it's treated as a corpse. And I amused myself and students for years afterward by putting oleic acid on live ants and watching them be picked up by their nest mates and just carried out and dumped on the refuse pile where corpses are placed. And then the ants had to, of course, pick themselves up and try to clean themselves off and get back into work inside the nest. But if they didn't get enough of that oleic acid off, then they would be picked up and dumped in the corpse pile again. And this kept on until finally they got clean enough to rejoin the living. That's sort of the night of the living dead.
No, were you able to analyze whether the living dead ants could do anything to protest being carried off?
Nothing whatsoever, because you see, there's nothing in the natural world that adds something like oleic acid to the body of ants. And ants are magnificently programmed to do certain things with great efficiency and speed, but there are many things they're not programmed to do because there's never been any occasion in their evolution for them to do it. And therefore, you can play tricks on ants. One of my favorite is to take a trail substance, which I first discovered back in the late 50s, in different kinds of ants. These are the substances that the ants lay down from particular glands in the rear part of their body, and the worker going outside the nest and finds a piece of food or a good place to build a new nest will lay a trail consisting of the material from that gland back to the nest. So once I discovered what that substance was and the gland was coming from, then I could bring the ants out anytime I wanted and take them anywhere I wanted. And in one extreme experiment I did, led a group of slave-making ants. These are ants that specialize on enslaving other kinds of ants and living off their labor. And I actually brought out armies of slave-making ants and had them milling around at the end of my artificial trail in confusion, wondering where the war was, where the battle was. They were brought out, and they didn't have any colony to attack and enslave.
You could make yourself a cult leader in the ant world.
Yes, indeed. It's possible, I think, with 20 or 30 substances, the key ones that the ants use to communicate chemically with, to have complete mind control of an ant colony. Let that be a lesson to us.
Well, really, say instead of being a brilliant scientist, you had a sick and perverse mind. I mean, you could use these ants for all kinds of unusual purposes, no?
Well, probably not, because most ant colonies are really rather delicate constructions, and they may seem annoying and ineradicable when they're living in the walls of your house, but when you start altering them a little bit, put them in the wrong environment, or messing up their communication system with trials of the kind that I've conducted, then the colony falls apart rather quickly.
What would happen to the world if all the ants were to magically disappear?
Terrible things. Let me preface my response by saying that, of course, we will do everything in our power to save the human species. That is the entire meaning of our own lives. But if the human species were to disappear from the Earth would go on unperturbed. In fact, the ecosystems of the world would regain their previous equilibrium, and short of some great meteorite strike, the planet could count on another billion years or so of undisturbed evolution amidst great biological diversity. But if ants, these little despised creatures at our feet, were to disappear, because they are such vital parts of the ecosystem on which the turning of the soil and the removal of dead animals and the predation on the kind of animals and so on is vital, if they were removed, then we would see a partial collapse of the ecosystems on the land. Probably many thousands of other species would become extinct soon afterward. Many plants would go extinct and so on. There would be a major reorganization and a depauperization of the land ecosystems. The world would suffer if it lost an important group like the ants.
I have one last question for you. Have you ever called an exterminator?
Only once. And that was when I had to remove, with my colleague Daniel Simberloff of Florida State University, who was working on his PhD with me at the time, when we designed an experiment in which we removed all of the insects and spiders and everything else from small mangrove islands in the Florida Keys. And the purpose of our experiment, we treated only a few islands out of thousands that exist, and with the approval of the National Park Service. The purpose was to create a sterile island so that we could study the recolonization by insects and spiders and other creatures. That was the first experiment on of this nature on the colonization of islands, and helped establish in the 1960s the principle that species do colonize until they reach some steady level of diversity on the island. That's the only time I ever called on an exterminator.
Are you morally against using them at home?
Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
Of course not. I'm not an extremist in terms of the handling of plants and animals. I tend to be something of an absolutist in terms of saving species. I think that, you know, it's inevitable that there should be always a very high turnover of individuals, organisms belonging to species, but the loss of species, that which is now has now reached a level of 1,000 to 10,000 times that which occurred before humanity came along, that is unconscionable, and I think we'll have to develop a much stronger environmental ethic to staunch that hemorrhage. I'm therefore something of an absolutist in wanting to save the species and races of plants and animals.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for the privilege.
E.O. Wilson recorded last fall after the publication of Journey to the Ants and his memoir, Naturalist. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Movement on the baseball strike, Noah?
Hi, Terry. Yeah, a federal judge in New York has issued an injunction against the major league owners. The owners will now let the season go ahead or lock out the players. The players say they're ready to play. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Haiti. President Clinton is there for a ceremony handing over control of the peacekeeping effort in Haiti to United Nations forces. Also, I'll talk with a reporter in Bujumbura, Burundi, about increasing tensions in that country between the Hutu majority and the Tutsi minority. Bob Mondello reviews a new Nick Nolte film about Thomas Jefferson. And I'll talk with Linda Ronstadt about her latest album. It's called Feels Like Home.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Verve Records has just released Charlie Parker with Strings, a new compilation CD of Parker's most popular albums. These recordings were originally made in 1949 and 1950. The new CD got commentator Gerald Early thinking about Parker and his music.
In the end, he had no private life, wrote Ralph Ellison about saxophonist Charlie Parker, and his most tragic moments were drained of human significance. Parker is surely a monumental figure in the history of African-American culture and in the history of American popular music. The prodigious jazz man who emerged from the badlands of the American Middle West and whose life was as dissipated as his playing was brilliant. He lived fast and died young and played for about 10 years, the most superb jazz ever heard. This month marks the 40th anniversary of his bizarre and unseemly death, and now Verve Records has released all the master takes of Charlie Parker with Strings, not only Parker's favorite album, but the most popular he ever made. I heard Charlie Parker for the first time when I was 13 or 14 and just beginning to listen to jazz seriously. The tune I heard was a corny ditty called Old Folks, which has recently been revived by several jazz musicians including Keith Jarrett, Steve Coon, and Gene Harris. The Parker recording included a vocal chorus, oboe, bassoon, clarinet, and French horn. It was, for a number of measures, one of the most wretched pieces of music I had ever heard.
For he's so diplomatic and so democratic, we always let him have his way.
When Parker finally entered, I was startled. He did not simply play well. He transformed the music entirely, lifted it to such exquisite proportions that I was moved beyond all telling. I had never heard a soloist outside of classical music play an instrument so daringly and with such keen eloquence. Why, I thought to myself at the time, would such a great musician want to play in such a setting? I wondered the same as I listened to Charlie Parker with strings, recordings I have heard dozens of times. I continue to be amazed and bemused by Parker's astonishing playing in a deadly unimaginative setting that would cripple most soloists. When I was either 17 or 18, I spent a period of about 8 weeks listening to nothing but recordings of Charlie Parker and Jimi Hendrix while reading and rereading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. It was at this time that I vaguely thought about becoming a writer, and the music of these two men inspired me in different ways to achieve that end. It was a time of wool gathering, but also a time of woodshedding or learning what it took to master a craft. I was struck, even at the time, with how similar both Parker and Hendrix were. Both were incredible soloists who completely transcended their musical surroundings. Both died young. Both seemed to be at creative dead ends at the times of their deaths. Both were known for riotous living. None of this seemed as important, however, as what both taught me about the tragic nature of a certain type of African-American genius. What stunned me about both men was not simply the impact of their innovations, but the intensity of their discipline. I was daunted by the immensity of their achievement, but inspired by the fact it could be done by sheer will. Parker could play in those wretched string settings because nothing challenged him more than the possibilities of his own genius at work. But I was warned by their wasteful deaths to be shrewder, more clever, for to be black must be to have the ability, like Melville's Ishmael, to survive and tell the tale. And I learned about the wondrous reinvention of the ordinary. Whenever I hear Parker with strings, I think of Hendrix's line, "You will never hear surf music again."
Gerald Early teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. His latest collection of essays, The Culture of Bruising, recently won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.